Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt and his movies.
I did it again.
I'm Dan Dixon.
My name is Joseph Earp.
And today we are talking about...
A masterpiece.
The second longest title film in the Brad Pitt catalogue, I think.
Is it shorter than The Assassination of Jesse James?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I got halfway through that title, yes. And then I was like, okay, this is...
The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
The Curious Case of... is maybe the most culturally long-standing impact of this film, right? People still make jokes about, like, The Curious Case of...
Just talking about culturally long-standing impact, I'm just going to take my phone off airplane mode and check Twitter, because I think it was... Sorry to start the podcast. Was it Mark Leidner?
Oh, yeah, the poet.
Look what he tweeted 2 hours ago. A bumper sticker.
I age in reverse like Benjamin Button.
He just tweeted that bumper sticker, just as I was...
So
it has made some cultural impact, unless he's referring to the F. Scott Fitzgerald
short
story. Have you read that?
I have. It's basically written for children. It's very short. It's one of the stories that Fitzgerald wrote to make money, because Fitzgerald, despite the cultural impact of The Great Gatsby, was not very financially successful over the course of his lifetime. Had a hard life, F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Sure, yes.
His wife, Zelda?
Zelda, yeah.
Was in a psychiatric ward that burnt down, is that correct? Died in a fire? She didn't die?
I don't think she might have. I know she was in a psychiatric ward because I think there's a bunch of stuff in Tender is the Night that's based on that.
And that he wrote very beautiful letters to her.
Yeah.
He called her Z. Oh.
But yeah, he had a hard time.
Turns out, sometimes, writing masterpieces guarantees you neither A, financial security...
Nor happiness,
as it turns out.
I don't know how recently you read it, but is there anything from that the movie takes from it, aside from the base concept?
Almost nothing.
It's interesting because...
Buttons feature in the short story.
It feels like a film that has a lot of details that would only be in there because they were taken from a book that it's based on. Not to discredit, not to say those details aren't artistically worthwhile.
What are you thinking? Hurricane Katrina.
That's so weird. Katrina thing is so weird. That's maybe one of the things that I'm not sure is necessary. I guess maybe the Tilda Swinton character, I understand her role. That feels odd. Even like a lot of the seafaring details, they seem so literary.
Dan, are we gonna argue?
Maybe. I'm open on this film. I'm willing to have my mind changed. Not even mind changed, my mind made up. It's not made up.
I knew that I liked this film, and I watched it 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I liked it even more than I remembered. And then I actually rewatched parts of it this morning, not to prepare for this podcast, but simply because they were rattling around my head. I agree with maybe what I think some of your criticisms are going to be, to guess ahead at what you're going to say. I think this is a slightly odd film, but I think this is a perfect example of a movie that... you watch it for the first time and you are unsettled, and then you watch it again and then you watch it again. And when you know its rhythms and you understand things that seem confusing, you just account for as being like, oh, of course, that's just what happens.
The guy who's struck by lightning.
Exactly. Yeah. These strange attempts at humor. We've previously called David Fincher one of the most humorless filmmakers working in America.
Yeah.
But when you get on the wavelength of the humor, and more than that, when you kind of see the humor as being inevitably tied up as just what happens in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, I think you can settle into it and there's more space to breathe, and that's when it flowers.
So I might quite like this film, actually, despite my suspicions of it or whatever, and despite I think what my general suspicions are around David Fincher. I think what I mean when I say that it feels like it's based on a book is there, in some ways, feels to be a fair... And this is what multiple rewatches might resolve. But in some way, it feels like there's a significant gap between the style of the film and its substance. It feels like it's not always familiar with the story that it's telling. Like, I mean, I think the Buttons is a good example in his, like, his biological father revealing himself to him. These things that are important in the kind of ebbs and flows of the story, but are either kind of under-treated or too much time is spent with them. I mean, it's a huge film with so much in it, where a lot of things are kind of, like, just glanced at.
I think I understood this film better on my most recent watch, when it just clicked into place for me that this is a fairy tale. In a kind of really deep mythic sense, this is a fairy tale. And the filmmaker who this reminded me of, strangely enough, was the American films of Guillermo del Toro. There's something of del Toro's
soft focus, kind of unsettling
darkness, because this is a fairy tale primarily about death and mortality.
Aging,
both
literally and figuratively dark.
Yes,
a lot of stuff happens at night in this film.
The entire kind of Tilda Swinton section is very soft focus, very dark, lots of shadows. And it also features one of Del Toro's most famous obsessions, which is clocks, clockwork. Now, every single Del Toro film has something about clocks in it. I mean, Pan's Labyrinth, the fascist commander, is obsessed with his little pocket watch. In the Hellboy movies, there are characters made out of clockwork. He's completely taken up with clockwork. And this film opens and ends with a clock that ticks backwards.
Yeah.
That is basically...
Which is beautiful.
It's so genuinely beautiful. The final shot of this film is, I think, deeply beautiful. It's just the clock covered in a drape with the water of Hurricane Katrina lapping up against it.
And it's continuing to tick. Despite being decommissioned.
I cried so many times watching this film.
Yeah.
I cried early and I continued to cry. Do you have something to confess? Are you going to confess it now?
Well, I go through emotional stages in my life, and I might be in a sequence now where I'm like, I'm busy, I got stuff going on. I don't want to spend too much time sitting with emotions. Not in a kind of crisis way, but just like, not for the moment. And I think some of these things in this film were a little hard to look at. And the central... And we'll talk about the plot at some point if it matters, and it...
It largely doesn't.
Yeah. Really.
I was thinking you could do a one-sentence version of the four-sentence game with this one.
The extraordinary thing, which is a man ages backwards.
Yeah.
Forwards.
And meets a bunch of people who die.
The foundation... The most moving thing about this film is the way in which, to use an academic word, it defamiliarizes aging, yet all the horror of aging backwards is just what we confront when we age. So the way in which it like shows you aging anew is kind of genius. I think that is the case. And I think part of my anxiety about judging this film is it seems like such an easy trick, and Fincher is not necessarily an intellectual director, that I'm like, does this film even know what it's doing?
I think it makes some extremely smart decisions that radiate outwards from the mere central gambit of Benjamin Button is born extremely old and then becomes ages in reverse, as you say, is the central trick. But I think there's other stuff that it's smart about.
It's somehow better than The Irishman, CGI-wise, right? So much better.
We have to do a pocket on the CGI.
We don't have to do it now, but I just kept thinking, like, how did, like, 15 years later, Scorsese not have a better handle on this?
Incredible. I mean, the effects are... They always feel like effects, but they also feel like a character.
Yeah.
The genius of Benjamin Button being a fully realized person who... Because, I mean, there's easily a version of this film where the CGI is problematic, or it doesn't look enough like Brad Pitt.
And or Cate Blanchett.
Or right, Cate Blanchett, exactly. Yeah. And it just feels... You don't get a sense of a linear progression of the character. No pun intended.
Yeah.
But you do. The young, wizened Benjamin Button that you meet is Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
And so there's a sense of consistency, which is astonishing. I wanted to say up front, the thing that this film reminds me of is Milan Kundera. I can't remember which book it is in. I'm pretty sure it's in The Unbearable Lightness of Being. He has this line where he says, life is pointless. because we live it forwards, not backwards. Yeah. And as a result, we can never tell what's going to happen. We make these decisions blind. They don't pay out properly. And he thinks life would have true value if we lived it backwards and we had the effects first and then the causes.
Yeah.
And then
I think that is the unbearable lightness of being. Yeah. It's a long time since I've read that book.
Yeah, yes. Me too. I read it when I was like 16, yeah, lying in the bath at my grandparents' place and just had my brain open.
Yeah.
I haven't returned to Kundera in a very long time, but sections of that book live with me. I mean, the section that makes up the title of that book, right? About, you know, life is not awful because it's so heavy and momentous. Life is awful because it's contingent and light is just...
It's indisputable.
Just beautiful. And I think that's what this film is about. I think all of these sections that seem disconnected and seem broken up from one another make sense to me when I think this is a film more than just about dying. It's a film about the unpredictability of the future. And that we know certain things will happen, but we can't prepare for other things. And that seems to connect the story of Captain Mike, who is the tugboat captain that Benjamin Button meets, who, you know, always wanted... He was told that he was going to be doomed to be a tugboat captain, but he considered himself an artist.
Yeah.
There's the guy who kept getting hit by lightning. There's the genuinely quite amusing scene where Benjamin Button goes to a faith healer and walks for the first time, yeah, and then the faith healer collapses and dies just after the
movie.
So that, I think there's so much of this film that's about unpredictability, unknowability, that the future is, in a terrifying rather than beautiful way, essentially unwritten, and we go through life very blind, and the one thing that we know with any kind of certainty is that we're going to die. Loss is inevitable. But even the ways in which we lose things become surprising and overwhelming to us. I think that resonated with me a lot because I am also, to do a brief biographical note, I'm going through a time in my life where, as has been documented on this podcast... Yeah.
And elsewhere.
And on Twitter, my Twitter. No, I'm doing better at not oversharing. I just went through a 3-month period where I lost a lot of things in very rapid succession.
Yeah.
I lost, for a while, I lost my house. I lost my dog. Like, it just went boom, 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 boom. And I think what I'm now having to settle with, kind of in the aftershock of those events, I had a long period of panic where I would say to you, we sat on town hall steps eating ice cream together, and I said, I mean, what's next? Like, what am I going to lose? And it made me feel extremely panicked taking every step into the next day, because I thought,
well... It feels like an irretrievable pattern, right? Yeah. When you're in those kinds of periods of your life.
Yeah, it just seemed like life was ganging up on me. This is just what's going to keep happening. Yeah. And so the unknowability of the future filled me with a terrible fear. And what I've, over the last couple of weeks, been better at doing is seeing the ways in which that unknowability of the future is also deeply beautiful.
Mm.
And there's something actually, I've just been obsessed with this word submission. And I think there's something really beautiful to submitting yourself to the unknowability of life. Because I've also had, over the course of those difficult 3 months, I've also had extraordinarily beautiful things happen to me. Some of the happiest things that have ever happened to me in my life. And those things have exactly the same logic as the bad things.
That's true.
They're unknowable. You just got to give yourself over to them. And I think that thesis is in Benjamin Button.
Yeah.
There's the character who teaches Benjamin how to play the piano, says to him something like, a fairly hackneyed quote, but it works. She says, you know, of course we lose the people we love. How else would we know that they are important to us?
Mm.
And that unknowability, the beauty of that unknowability, seems an essential part of this, I'm going to say it, excellent film.
Is it... I mean, I guess this is always the question with Fincher. And we have watched... This is the fourth film of his that we've watched for this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Mank, Seven.
Yeah.
Fight Club. A wild...
Yeah.
array of films.
Totally. But there's always the sense of how earnest is he being?
Mm.
And I think often, pretty earnest, but then he does surprise you. Mm. He does, like, Fight Club, we've talked about him being humorless and kind of struggling with the comedy of Fight Club, which is, like, quite strange, but there... Seven has no jokes. Oh, actually, it has one joke in which Brad Pitt misreads Sard, like the Marquis of de Sard is Marquis de Chardet.
Incredible.
Which is a very good joke, actually. I wonder if that's Brad Pitt's.
Maybe. Not impossible.
But there is this constant sense in this film, I think, of... It's very serious. It's a very serious film.
Hmm.
But is it... I guess my constant concern is it too serious? Is it too in love with its own thesis? I enjoyed this film, the second watch. When I saw this at the cinemas, I think you sent me a clip of the Oscars, which we will talk about, when Benjamin Button was nominated, the year Benjamin Button was nominated. And I have a feeling there were a couple of years like this around the mid-2000s where I was kind of aware of movie culture to some extent, obviously never totally immersed in it, but kind of... in some kind of scattered way. And I made an effort to kind of see a bunch of films nominated for Oscars. And I think this was one of those years that I had seen, like, most of the Best Picture nominees at the cinemas.
Hmm.
And I wonder if I saw Benjamin Button because...
You were ticking
it was nominated. Yeah, exactly. And I just remember being, as I think I've talked about on previous episodes, pretty bored with it. And relieved when it was over and felt like it just... Looking back, I wonder how much of that, seeing it in the cinema, has to do with its... unusual structure in which it's not really signaling when it's coming to an end.
No.
Because sure, you have the lifespan of Benjamin as a kind of structuring element of the film, but it speeds through the last 25, 30 years pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And I think there's a sense when you're watching, when you just don't know what it will be focusing on, don't know where it will be taking your attention. And that sense of possible endlessness and interminability, even though it's very, also very specifically about its ending and kind of, you know, the ending from the beginning, is challenging, or was challenging for me at that time.
And remain challenging you?
No, not as much on the rewatch. Not as much. But I think I was struck by how strangely it was structured.
It goes in spurts.
Yeah.
It really goes in spurts. Benjamin, it looks at Benjamin's quote-unquote childhood, in which he's a kind of ancient man. That goes very slowly.
Yeah.
It's like
a third of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. And then suddenly speeds up and then goes slow again for this dalliance with the Tilda Swinton character and then speeds up again. I think...
You get like 4 or 5 little chapters from his life, basically.
Essentially, yeah. You have his childhood in a old people's home.
Yeah.
Which I think is one of the excellent decisions that the film makes.
Yeah.
I love those opening sequences in which he's, you know, treated as though he's an old person because he's living in an old person's home and he becomes so acquainted with death. I mean, those sequences, I think, are just beautiful.
It handles the reverse aging extremely well, not just in terms of makeup and effects, but in terms of how it might be if someone were... It feels like a very plausible picture of what it might be like if someone were to age backwards, both in terms of their mental development, their physical development.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wonder if Fincher's precision as a director is necessary for that, because it's, you don't really notice it because it's done so well, and if it wasn't, it would ruin the film.
Yeah,
it doesn't try to make jokes about it, really. It always takes it seriously in a way that does, that is important, I think.
We were talking on the phone last night and we kind of had some brief discussions about this film, and I said to you that I was kind of discomforted by the fact that it was Fincher directing this film, because I said something like, he makes films about murderers, and he's weird when he's not making films about murderers. And actually, the thing that clicked for me this morning when I was just watching back key sequences is, I guess I just suddenly realized, oh no, it's not so much that Fincher is obsessed with murderers. Fincher is obsessed with procedures. He's a procedural filmmaker, and Benjamin Button is a procedural film.
And also, like, the great procedure is death, right? Which is the concern of both murderers and aging.
Yes, yeah. It made so much more sense to me this morning as a Fincher film. And
Mank screenwriting
exactly
process.
It's exactly.
What happens next?
he is a filmmaker who the thing he front loads is characters working on procedures, and through that he reveals who they are as people. I mean, that's what I think one of my favorite things about Seven is that film establishes itself so quickly.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Because all it does is goes, here's the Brad Pitt character's relationship to procedures, here's the Morgan Freeman's character's relationship to procedures, off you go. And you see who they are, not because they give like long conversations about their relationships, but because they just get down to work. You haven't seen Gone Girl, but Gone Girl is also a film about one character who is just obsessed with this very complicated, scary procedure.
And there's the Edward Norton undertaking the procedure of working out his own mind, right? Yeah. Like, particularly, I mean, I wonder if that applies to the first half of Fight Club. Probably in some ways, but it definitely applies to the second half, which is like, I have done all this stuff, what did it mean?
Yeah, yeah. I think this film kind of suddenly made sense to me through that lens, that what we're looking at is, yeah, a film that takes almost a procedural approach to what life is. Yeah. There's something kind of mechanistic about its approach to life. It's, you know, oh yeah, you just get used to this pattern, and the pattern of life is people you love die. Mm. And that's established very early, and it really works. I wanted to highlight a couple of things in particular. One is, this film features a range of actors who were not famous when the film came out, who have since become famous. The biggest one being Mahershala Ali as the...
Who's weirdly highly billed on this film.
Is he?
Despite barely appearing in it. I think so. On the Wikipedia page, he's like listed fourth. Huh. Which only makes sense... Maybe that's... I don't know.
That doesn't make
a lot of sense. No, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Because he's not famous at the time and he doesn't appear in the film much. But no. It's like his second project, right?
Is it really? I think it's that early.
Yeah. Because I saw him and like, I was like, wait a second, is that Mahershala Ali? What's going on?
Yeah, he's incredible in the film.
He's really good.
How many actors do we have who exude such a natural sense of dignity? That's what I was thinking.
Actually, yeah, the Richard Brody, the foil and friend, recently had a list of the greatest actors of the... or the greatest performances of the 21st century. And my partner was reading it and like made me guess who might be on there. And the only one I actually correctly guessed was Mahershala Ali in
Moonlight.
Moonlight, yeah.
He's unbelievable.
Yeah, it was just the most obvious. It felt like the one which you can't leave out.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary performance. But the person who I wanted to spotlight, that I wanted to use as a way of getting you to watch something you need to watch, is one of my all-time favorite performers, is Jared Harris, who plays Captain Mike.
Oh.
Who...
He's fun.
He's real good. He's just natural and talented and can just show
up. Is he actually
up.
British?
Yes, he is, yeah.
Because he has a British accent. He's British in the film.
He is the son of Richard Harris.
Oh.
Extremely famous star of British stage and screen, and Dumbledore before he died and was taken over by Michael Gambon. Jared Harris plays one of the on-screen characters who I have the most kinship with. He plays a character called Lane in Mad Men, who is like a very put-together, slightly crumpled British man who comes to work at an American ad agency and whose life basically falls apart. And he's so good, he's so genuine, he's so warm. And because you need to watch it, I'm not going to spoil it for you. But something happens to Lane, which is known amongst Mad Men circles as kind of the shocking moment in the series. And it devastated me for some time.
Okay.
It's an extraordinarily orchestrated moment of pure shocking grief that like reverberates through the culture of anyone who's seen the show.
It's crazy that I haven't watched it. I don't know why I haven't watched it. I want to watch it.
Start it.
Yeah. Okay.
First season is incredible. It's not one of those shows that people say to you stuff like,
yeah,
first two seasons are slog.
No, it's true.
I'm watching Star Trek The Next Generation for the first time at the moment. Huh. And everyone had warned me, oh, the first two seasons are such a drag. And I'm having such a good time.
It's great to have your expectations lowered, I will say that.
Yeah. But no, Mad Men starts great and continues great. The other thing I wanted to kind of pocket as its own thing to talk about, one of the subplots of the film that is kind of intermittently picked up is that, so Benjamin Button is born to a wealthy white family. Yes. The wife dies in childbirth.
Because the father is furious that the wife, like, it is as if the baby has killed the wife, so he takes the baby and rushes off through the night.
Because the baby looks hideous as well.
Oh yeah, also the baby looks like a nightmare because it's an old man baby.
Have you seen Batman Returns? One of the best films ever.
Don't know. I've seen one of those early Batmans when I was a kid, but I don't remember which one.
You should really, Batman Returns, 5-star masterpiece. Okay. And that
is the film with Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze?
No.
I think that's the one I've seen.
Please.
Sorry.
No, Batman Returns is Danny DeVito as the Penguin. Oh, yeah. Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman.
Sure.
Christopher Walken as a bad guy modeled on fucking Count Dracula in Carl Theodore Dreyer's vampire film. So it's like a gothic fantasia in which Batman almost entirely does not appear. He's in like a handful of scenes, and Burton got away with that because he made the first Batman film. It was a colossal smash, and he said to the studio, now I want to do what I want to do.
Wow.
And he made this wildly dark, unpleasant, deeply fetishistic and sexual, ostensibly a children's film, and the studio were like, get the fuck off this lot, never darken our doorways again. And they handed over to Joel Schumacher, who made two extremely camp, including a Mr. Freeze one. Yeah.
Okay.
That was meant to be a course correct after Batman Very Returns. Very funny. Which the studio, one of those moments, great moments in history where a studio gives a creative complete control and then goes, oh no,
yeah,
we fucked up. Batman Returns opens with Pee Wee Herman playing a rich dude who has a baby born that's a hideous baby. It's the Penguin. And he goes and throws it into the river. And that just as marvelous. Just as an opening sequence, it's very similar to the scene in Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
I should really watch that.
It's you would have an incredible time. I can't recommend it enough.
You were talking about something that's talked about. The rich white family.
Yeah, I wanted to sidebar the subplot about Button's dad for two reasons.
Yeah.
Number one, it's for me one of the most moving parts of the film. It's very simple. Again, almost hackneyed. I think the film constantly walks the line between being hackneyed and being quite earnest. The father throws the baby away and then essentially spends the rest of his life monitoring Benjamin from afar, not revealing the fact that he's Benjamin's father, getting drunk with him, pretending to kind of just be a friend. And that actor, whose name I actually don't know, who plays Button's father, I think just does this look of regret that immediately moved me and continued to move me throughout the film. He just plays it as a guy who just really, really feels bad for what he's done.
Yeah. You don't get much of him on the page either.
No.
He's not drawn in any particular depth. And I think you get a lot out of him from that performance. And from also how he's filmed. Like, I think Fincher does a lot to make that character, give that character some depth. But it is a I guess that is the thing from, that is what happens in the short story, more or less?
More or less. I just think it's really beautiful and deeply moving. But I also think it's worth sidebarring because this film is, in an abstract, tangential way, about race. It contains a lot that is not a cohesive thesis.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But there's definitely a lot about race in this film.
Yeah.
First and foremost, Hurricane Katrina is the kind of bracketed narrative device of the film.
I don't think we've talked about the flashback mechanism, which is that so Cate Blanchett through the film is the love of Benjamin Button's life
from the moment he sees her.
Yeah, as when he, which is handled given the strangeness of the subject, handled fairly sensitively, that he's kind of this old man child and she's this kind of young girl. And the film is structured with her dying in her hospital bed in New Orleans, talking to her daughter, who turns out to also be Benjamin's daughter, and getting her to read, getting her daughter to read out aloud Button's diaries, which the daughter has never seen before and did not realize until reading them that he's in fact her father. And the diaries serve as the voiceover for the drama of the film.
Yeah. And you have the, no pun intended, ticking clock of the fact that as she's dying in this hospital bed, Hurricane Katrina is approaching.
Yeah.
And getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And she dies with Hurricane Katrina kind of breaking through the hospital.
Do we have any theories? Why Katrina?
I think
it's such a like fascinating choice, but I don't know. Aside from general, like something. I mean, we can. I am interested in the race question in this film because I think it is something that Fincher never really explicitly discusses here, but is obviously a concern. The Katrina thing kind of baffled me.
I think Katrina feeds into the thesis of the film, as I read it, about the unknowability of the future, even though we have these constants like death, destruction, loss, which obviously Katrina represents. There's a lot early on in the film of the nurses, the people on TV, being like, don't worry, it's fine, it's all under control, it's getting pretty bad out there, but we're safe.
Yeah.
And the film is so much about moving towards a future which will have so many surprises for you that you could never account for. And I think Katrina is just kind of almost like a force of fate or a force of chaos in some way.
Yeah, that's fair. Which is also, when was this film made?
2008 it came out.
So not very long after Katrina.
No, which is really interesting because they've been trying to make this film since the 90s.
Yeah.
And it was Fincher and Pitt signing on that kind of kicked it into the next gear, obviously. Yeah, I mean, weirdly, it's one of those things, the film's discussion and treatment of race mean that there's not much to say, in, I think, a way that's to the film's credit.
Yeah.
That it just presents itself as containing class divide, race divide. Button is born from a wealthy white family, but the family that adopt him are African American. And the film is kind of simple in the way that David Hume uses that word in its approach to race. That it kind of, you kind of can't break it down or say anything further about it.
Yeah. Not within the vocabulary of the film, at least.
No, because essentially it's doesn't have much more to say. Yeah. I'm drinking fake gin with Nexpa sugar-free iced tea. I made one for Dan too. Is it good?
It is good. It's kind of smoky.
It's the botanicals in the fake gin.
Kind of
fake. Should we do the CGI? It's incredible. Yeah.
So there's one scene which I think doesn't work that well.
Mm-hmm. Which one?
It's when young Brad Pitt returns to the Kate Blanchett's dance studio.
Yeah, sure.
And his eyes are a little big and her makeup doesn't quite work. I think it's the only scene where it kind of took me out of it a little bit.
Yeah.
Which is funny because you have a lot of Brad Pitt on, and maybe it's because they have so much to work with. Like, with old Brad Pitt, you're like, oh yeah, maybe that's what old Brad Pitt looks like. But we know what young Brad Pitt looks like. Kind of the trouble with The Irishman, where young De Niro doesn't look anything like actual young De Niro.
Just nothing like.
Yeah, at least this actually does look quite a lot like cutting class Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Whatever. It feels a little shiny and smooth.
Yeah.
But overall, magnificent.
I think one of the things I said in the episode that we did on The Irishman was that I just didn't know why they had to use CGI at all. Like, why ape reality? And I think what makes this, one of the things that makes this CGI work so well is that it just doesn't pretend to look naturalistic.
Yeah, it's
because it's non-naturalistic.
It plays into the fairy tale.
Yes, exactly.
Because even when he's an old man, he's a child old man, so maybe he's got like a bit more of a spring in his step. There's kind of, it's not Uncanny Valley because there is not a real referent to which it's trying, that it's trying to imitate necessarily.
Yeah.
And like the old man baby, again, a thing that doesn't exist.
Exactly. And so there's a sense in which it has freed itself from the constraints of trying to look real, so it takes on an important character of its own. The other thing to say is that Fincher is quite... So do you know how they did Young Button?
No.
So they had a physical actor with a CGI sock over their head. So Fincher is actually one of the filmmakers who popularized this way of doing things, because the Winklevoss twins in The Social Network, there were two actors on set, Armie Hammer plus someone else, and the second person wore a sock over their head.
That would have been such an insane thing to see on set.
Yeah, exactly. So what makes it work is that, I think, is that there's a lot of real physical stuff in front of the camera, and we're moving increasingly away from that. This is like... I got a creaky throat. Hang on a second. Gotta have some fucking fake gin. Turns out smoking is bad for you. Turns out it does weird things to your body. No one told me this.
There's a Car Seat Headrest song about it.
Yeah. Stop smoking, we love you. Yeah. But there's a bit later in the same album where it shifts and it goes, start smoking, we love you.
I've forgotten about that.
So yeah. Who could tell whether smoking's good or not?
The jury's out.
The jury's out. I really want to start just pretending like I've never heard that smoking's bad for me. I want to be like, I'm feeling kind of... I got like a weird cough in the mornings. I don't really know what's going on. Turns out, these things...
Wait, these what?
That you can buy in the...
They just let you buy them?
Yeah, what the fuck? Someone should do something about this. I can just go into the shop and buy something that kills me. What the fuck? What the hell was I talking about?
CGI, oh, all the real stuff in front of the camera.
Yeah, so you have a physical actor in front of the camera in a physical location, and it's the sock on the head that's different. Okay. So therefore...
So is Brad Pitt even in that scene? For like, I mean, I guess he's doing the voice.
His head is filmed separately, so it's his face.
How much of the film...
It went up until he's on the tugboat with Captain Mike. You know that?
Yeah,
that
and bit. They're like, wow, you've grown. You're taller.
Yeah, and then it's just Brad Pitt and prosthetics.
I mean, it's... Wow.
Before that, it's a... Brad Pitt's not on set.
I assumed he'd been made up.
No.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So they filmed his head separately in front of a green screen background.
You buy it. I didn't know.
It's incredible. It's...
I mean, I obviously knew that that's not Brad Pitt's body, but I assumed it was, you know, like The Hobbits or something. Like, it was forced perspective or...
Yeah. No. Mm. Really good. It's really works. Good.
Yeah.
Which is good, because this would be one of those films, if the CGI didn't hold up, you just have to take... like 2 stars off the film.
Yeah,
because you would just be forced out of the movie. You wouldn't be able to watch it, no matter how interesting you would find it.
Yeah,
I think that's what's going to happen to The Irishman, to be honest with you. I think it looks shit on the first run.
It'll look worse
yeah. So quickly.
It's a shame, because it's a tremendous movie,
but it suffers so much. The technology was just not ready, and I don't know why Scorsese rushed it. I was talking to my housemate Tristan about that film the other day, and he felt like his problem with it is that Scorsese had taken on too much late career artist discourse, and it's such a film about kind of being in your late career. He just thought it was kind of too self-reflexive in like in a slightly creepy way. That Tristan.
I buy that.
The other film that this really, really resembles to me, shockingly so, and not only because it prompted a broadly similar emotional response, this is very Me, Joe Black.
Particularly in the way, in its kind of metaphysical concerns.
Yeah, it is Brad Pitt as an outsider moving through a world, helping people with their problems. The tone is similarly kind of... We describe Meet Joe Black as being like a children's film with all the scenes that you'd expect cut out.
Fairy tale-like.
Mm-hmm.
It is...
And also so, about race. Meet Joe Black is also about race.
Not in a great way.
Not in a good way. I'm not making that claim.
Also a film about race in which Brad Pitt is immortal, Interview with a Vampire. Not about race in a bad way.
Yeah.
What is it about Brad Pitt that makes him this kind of... Not quite emo, but like... He's not quite of this world. And it's not... Because he's not... His beauty isn't like an angelic or transcendent beauty. It's very grounded.
Yeah. It's very American.
Yeah. So, but there seems to be something about him.
I think early on, some directors recognized, and then later in his career, Pitt recognized himself and pushed it. The thing that everyone says about him, that he's a character actor in a leading man's body. And that means he is the beautiful yet removed and alien figure who is not entirely of this world or is uncomfortable or discomforted in some way.
The scene I think about with respect to that in a film we'll talk about in a while is when he's driving through LA in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Extraordinary sequence. Yeah. I was thinking about how much I like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood today.
It's very memorable.
Yeah.
I feel like I can... Because we saw that around the same time, obviously, as Ad Astra.
Yeah.
I can much remember the details of many more scenes. I could probably basically work through Once Upon a Time in my head in a way that I couldn't with Ad Astra.
Yeah. I've watched Once Upon a Time a bunch more times since I've seen it. And I think the best thing that Tarantino has ever done in his entire career is the sequence with the neon turning on and Baby Baby You're Out of Time by the Rolling Stones playing.
Yeah,
just this montage of like lights turn. It's just
really good.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about it.
Yeah.
What scenes in this film made me cry? I mean, the ending just bowls me over.
Yeah, it's hard. Cate Blanchett, we haven't talked about her. No. She's amazing.
She's unbelievable.
It makes sense that she is... Is she Australia's most successful actor? Probably. In terms of, like, artistically and commercially, if you look at that.
Almost certainly.
Yeah, I don't know who else there would be.
No.
Like, the people in the next tier... I'm sure Hemsworth has a bigger box... Well, maybe he doesn't have a bigger box office, but is obviously very commercially successful. Toni Collette is now in, like, everything... TV, etc.
But Collette took a winding path. Blanchett was early, extremely successful.
And has just consistently been in everything.
Yeah.
And basically good in everything.
Yeah. I don't always love Blanchett as much as some people.
Yeah.
But I think, say, her performance in Todd Haynes' Carol, which is just...
I haven't seen that. I must see that.
It's a perfect film. It's so fucking good. And she's next level in that film.
Yeah.
She tones it. I think sometimes she goes to Blanche DuBois, and it's just a bit too much.
So that voice, she has the kind of rounded vowels.
Yeah, and it can sometimes just take me out of the project.
Very acting school.
Yeah, very acting school. I saw her on stage doing Blanche DuBois, so that's maybe why it's
very
always
funny.
Stuck in my head. And she was excellent.
Right? Yeah, I bet she was.
But she just needs to be used in a very particular way. And here she keeps things kind of under control. I think she does a subtle and pretty beautiful performance.
Mm. I agree. She's also someone who is very good at timelessness. She seems at once, you know, old and young and...
Yeah.
And loss. Like, Blanchett is so good at loss.
Because there's something kind of classic. Are we too quiet?
We might have dropped a little bit.
Let's turn the fucking volume up. Let's fucking... Abel Ferrara's Driller Killer starts with a little title card that just says play this film loud.
That's right.
And like that's what we should do with this podcast. There's something kind of weirdly timeless and kind of classic about this film as well. It kind of feels slightly throwback, and it was marketed in a slightly throwback way, I think.
Yeah.
The poster was just their two faces kind of cut in half next to each other. There's, maybe now is the time to talk about the Oscars, because I think it dovetails in.
I'm going to have a look at who was nominated.
Well.
That year.
It's an extremely significant year in Oscar.
I should look.
But there was a film that was notably, extremely notably, not nominated, and it changed the face of the Oscars. Do you know what that film was?
The Dark Knight?
Yes.
Interesting.
So this year at the Oscars...
Which I didn't see at the cinema that year. I saw that, like, someone gave it to me on a hard drive. Like,
incredible.
Which is weird that I didn't see... It's odd that I did not see that film.
Dark Knight. A great film.
Yeah.
A really good film.
It's a lot of fun.
It's just heat with Batman in
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
so of course
it's
good.
And Heath Ledger as the Joker is pretty good. It's
one of the all-time great performances. It's astonishing that we've had two people try and do the Joker after Heath Ledger, and no one's even come close.
Yeah.
I think Joaquin Phoenix is pretty good in Joker, a film that I think is actually...
Have we talked about that film on the podcast?
Yeah, okay. So many times.
No, I mean, since I've seen it.
Oh, since you've seen it?
Yeah.
You know, maybe I didn't know that you've seen it. When did you watch it?
A while ago.
Fuck.
I think it might have been over, like, the Christmas period where we didn't record for, like, an extended period of time.
Did you have a good time with it?
It was so mean.
In a cool way.
I don't know. It felt like the interesting stuff in the movie would happen after the movie to me. I'm like, oh, now everything's... It also felt... I love The King of Comedy so much. And it just seemed to miss the point of that film in some ways. In its very on-the-nose allusions.
I think... Again, the thing that unlocked that film for me is just the fact that have you seen all the Best Picture
nominees? I've seen all the Best Picture nominees, yeah.
Fucking terrible year.
Juno.
Yeah, fucking awful year.
Michael Caine's a fine film. I mean, There Will Be Bloods, obviously, yeah.
Wait,
I'm looking at the wrong year.
Yeah, that's a good year.
Yeah.
It's the 2009 Oscars.
I looked up 2008 because it was quite came out, of course.
Yeah. No, 2008 was incredible. 2008 was No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood. I don't mind Michael Clayton. Joker is a movie about class.
I haven't seen The Reader, but I saw all the others. Yeah.
It's just about class.
Sure.
And our culture.
And social services.
Yes, and it's smart and good and intelligent about those things.
Which is funny, because isn't the director kind of like a Republican? Or at least anti-cancel culture.
He's anti-cancel culture. Those things are not
similar. Those things aren't the same, yeah.
I think I'm anti-cancel culture in the way
that... Yeah, I mean, I just don't know what it is. I guess would be my position.
Yeah. I think we need... Anyway.
Yeah. Not now.
Not now. Not... Well, you can't dovetail from it. Yes! You can't... You can't... I'm going off one medication and going on to a new medication, and that means that I'm having it's a tough time. I'm having physical withdrawal symptoms. That's why I sound a little bit snotty. Runny nose is a very common side effect of going off the medication that I'm going off.
Annoying.
I feel ill. I'm not really eating nor sleeping. And in order to get me through this time, I have a series of signs written, scrawled in my crazy handwriting and stuck to the wall. And one of them says, "You are withdrawing from insert medication here. What you think and feel may be changed by that." And another one says, "During this period, avoid making any long-term decisions. Your decision-making may be affected." And as I started talking about cancel culture, Dan was furiously pointing at that sign. Good advice. Wonderful advice. Because cancel culture means that if I got cancelled, this would not be counted as a valid excuse.
Exactly.
Because people think there's no such thing as excuses for any kind of behavior.
We could, We need
full stop.
It's an important conversation.
Just not for
the Brad Pitt card, not for the Curious Case Adventure Button episode.
Oh, ow. I also got an ECG this morning because I had to get one for the medications I'm going on. And I got covered in stickers.
Oh, yeah.
And they've, like, left all this gunk in my leg hair.
Yeah.
Oh, awful.
Anyway.
Joker is a movie about class.
Yeah.
And we live in a culture that never talks about class, because the only people who would talk about class are the left, and the cultural arbiters of the left are usually private school educated rich people who don't want to talk about class, because it will mean admitting that you're Gia Tolentino and your parents are extremely rich and famous, or you're Mitski and your parents are extremely rich and famous,
or not famous, as is the case with Mitski, for reasons.
Or you're Chloe Zhao, director of Nomadland and The Rider, and your father is a billionaire.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Yeah, the culture just doesn't talk about that.
Speaking of films about class, the winner of Best Picture, in the Oscars in 2009. Slumdog Millionaire.
One of the worst films ever made. One of the worst films ever made.
I remember seeing that at the cinema and thinking it was fine. I'm sure it wasn't. I did not have a developed sense of taste. But yeah, I saw at the cinema that year,
Read out the Best Picture nominees.
Best Picture nominees. Slumdog Millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Mm-hmm.
Frost Nixon.
Fucking awful Milk. Film.
The Reader.
Milk's okay.
So I saw Milk at the cinema, and I think that was my take. Josh Brolin is good in Milk.
Josh Brolin's great.
Probably better than... Sean Penn's fine.
Sean Penn's pretty good.
Yeah.
He gets carried away with the voice in a way that means that he doesn't really connect with the performance, yeah. I think. It's a little bit parodic.
Yes. SNL-y.
Yeah.
Frost Nixon, fine. Not great.
I think it's a bad film.
Yeah.
It makes up the pivotal climax, and I just hate historical films that just... insert a fiction.
That does suck.
Are the Best Director nominees just the Best Picture nominees?
Maybe.
I love years where they smuggle in.
Nominated much. Like, there's not many nominations for each category. I forgot how, Best Director, Fincher. Danny Boyle, Fincher, Ron Howard, Gus Van Sant, Stephen Daldry, the Reader. So yeah, it's literally nominees. Exactly 3, 4, 5. It's exactly the same. And the same winner.
I have to say this now. I interviewed Danny Boyle. Mm-hmm. I think I've said this on the podcast before, but
you've talked to me about it. Maybe, yeah. Oh, The Wrestler. Changeling, I saw that as well. Anyway, sorry.
Changeling's good. Wrestler's good. I like The Wrestler okay. It's probably Darren Aronofsky's least stupid film, which is good.
Okay.
Because most of his films are stupid. I'm about to sneeze. No, I'm not. I'm keeping that the fuck in the edit. I interviewed Danny Boyle for the release of Trainspotting 2. And can I just say, for the record, I have interviewed people for a very long time, and most people are not pleasant that you interview. The ruling share, 80% of people, particularly successful people, are just horrible. Like, not only not good, but actively rude. And
you're also a very thoughtful... Like, you put a lot of thought into your interviews.
I tried really hard. I prepared a lot.
You
ask good questions,
and you normally know the thing you're interviewing them about. I would be surprised if you have interviewed a director without watching the film, for instance.
Yeah, I avoid asking questions that I think everyone else is going to ask.
Yeah.
And the two nicest people, by far, that I've ever interviewed are George Saunders, who was...
Makes sense.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, you never hear a bad word about that man.
No. And Danny Boyle. Danny Boyle was so nice, so kind, so friendly, so humane, was so giving, said such interesting things, was so tireless. He'd been on the junket for like 4 days. Just lovely. I cannot explain how lovely he was. We talked about... he let me do things like... When he started in the film industry, he worked under Alan Clark, who's a really great British director, mostly for the small screen. And he just let me ask him a bunch of questions about fucking Alan Clark when he's there, talking about Trainspotting 2. And he was so chuffed that I wanted to talk about that. Like, just... Wow. So,
so when you say Slumdog Millionaire is one of the worst films ever made...
Danny Boyle has made some of the worst films ever made. Yeah. Really, genuinely, he has. Like, Yesterday is... I can't believe it exists.
Did he make
that? He's the director of Yesterday.
Have you watched that film?
Yes, film? Yes.
It's astonishingly bad. Because I'm sure we've talked about this before. We must have.
You watched it on the plane.
Yeah, I watched it on the plane.
The John Lennon stuff is unbelievable. Yeah. Genuinely unbelievable.
It's all the worst things about the kind of British sensibility of light humour.
Fuck.
It's unbearable. A film that could only be watched on a plane.
Yeah.
When you are like just trying to remind yourself that just seeking something that will make you not think about the fact that you could just fall out of the sky.
I'm getting my motorcycle license. Mm. A good opportunity to say this film's iconic motorbike or sequences with Brad Pitt. And I'm sorry, Dan, for what I'm about to say. I know it's going to upset you slightly. As part of the motorcycle course, which I've actually done before, but I let my license lapse.
Sure.
Useless piece of information that I just needed to tell you, just so you didn't think that I hadn't already done this. the instructor was pressing the need for wearing gloves. And he said, because imagine, when you fly off your bike, imagine that you are putting your...
I'm already thinking about it.
Imagine that you are putting your hands on a cheese grater, and not only that you're doing that, that you're doing repeatedly, and you're holding it down at length. That's what it's like when you come off your bike without gloves. Equivalent to the experience of watching yesterday. Really, genuinely. It's the closest I've ever come to just feeling like I'm just sitting there putting my hands over and over again on a cheese grater.
There's so much that is bad about it. It is really challenging to talk about. You could do one of those podcasts where you just watch
minute by minute
yesterday and minutely dissect why it's terrible. Yeah. And there'll be plenty of material, like 90 minutes on every minute. Yeah. Easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so funny.
Yeah.
It's so bad.
I genuinely can't believe that it exists.
It's shocking that it feels like, I think there's this sense, I think, that doesn't seem to be around as much anymore, but I think especially when I was young, a sense of like Britain as being a particular kind of sophisticated that America is unable to attain. And cultural content like yesterday just so aggressively destroys that myth.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is, it's genuinely sickening. It belongs to a category of film, because there's films that are, you know, like The Room, which is, it's so funny, it's so like bad, like poorly made that it becomes an intensely pleasurable experience. And then there's bad films that are just bad and like, oh, they're boring, I'm like Ocean's 12. Yesterday belongs to a category of the just so bad, not at all entertaining, but such an extraordinarily intense example of that I would almost recommend watching.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you will, it's kind of beyond. Cause I think there's part of that experience of The Room is astonishment. Yesterday is definitely a worse film than The Room.
Yeah, 100%. The Room is a good film.
I don't know if I would say that, but anyway, I would encourage. It actually, you know what? Oh, it came up when I finished on Netflix. I finished Benjamin Button. That was the Netflix screen yesterday. Really? Yeah. I don't know why I didn't say that before.
Incredible.
So the algorithm thinks that's what I'm up for next.
After Curious Case of Benjamin.
Actually, something else I wanted to do, just speaking about Netflix, am I interrupting something we're talking about?
I was going to say something, but all I was going to say is that I told this to you earlier today. Fincher loses Best Director to Danny Boyle. That's right. And when they're doing the roll call of directors, they say Fincher's name and they cut to Fincher. And he looks so fucking pissed off.
Yeah. He looks. This is not him losing. This is him just being named as a nominee.
He's like sitting there, he like straightens his face. He's probably doing it as a joke because he has a very sardonic sense of humor in interviews and stuff. And someone like woots for him, and he looks over at them like kind of grumpily.
Fuck off, yeah.
And then he loses. And then Danny Boyle gets up and is like extremely nice and like very flattered.
Has Fincher won an Oscar?
Never.
Okay.
He hasn't been nominated very many times.
Mm. I guess not. Like, what? Well, yeah. Not Gone Girl?
Nope. No. Shit. Mm. And he's gonna lose.
Mike's not gonna win. Yeah. Do we have nominees yet? We don't.
No. I think they get announced today.
Oh, for real?
I think so.
Oh, that's exciting. I mean, something. I don't know if it's exciting.
It's gonna be a Nomadland sweep. It just will be. Best Picture, probably Best Director as well.
Sure.
Chloe Zhao. She can put it next to the billions that she inherited.
What's that thing that Frances McDormand said when she won like the Golden Globe or something? Two words.
Yeah.
Something Ryder. I don't know.
Yeah, and no one knew what the fuck she was talking about. Because I think she didn't expand, right?
She just did that and walked off.
Yeah. What were you going to say?
Oh, yeah. I'm interested. Because you know how Netflix, I'm not sure what the variety is, but Netflix will consider the kind of film viewer you are and show you an image for each thing accordingly. Yeah. My image of Benjamin Button was kind of like the Tilda Swinton era of Brad Pitt.
Huh.
And I was wondering what yours would be.
Mine was Kate and Brad looking at each other.
Interesting. Yeah, mine was like the older, the kind of...
And just Brad?
Yeah, it was just an old like an old young, like when he's got the beard and the long hair, sea dog Brad Pitt.
Huh. I wonder what that means.
Yeah.
I mean, this film made me reflect on the fact, and maybe that Netflix image shows it, I posted a list of my 100 favorite films on my Twitter.
Oh, I didn't see that.
I'll
check that out.
I made a top 100 on Mubi. It's completely arbitrary. If I sure, did it today, I'd do it completely differently.
I know you well enough to know that.
But I did screenshots of kind of each section. I made this beautiful Mubi list.
I'm excited to look at it.
And I had a screenshot of the top four, and they were...
The Exorcist?
Exorcist was position number 11.
Okay.
It's been number one for such a long time. I just thought, like, you know what?
Mix it up.
Reshuffle.
Safe?
Safe it was number two.
Killing Them Softly?
No.
Sweet Smell of Success?
Mm-hmm. Number three. What's number one? I made you watch it recently. We watched it apart. Just the best. The best.
Not The Assassination of Jesse James.
Like a serial killer stole a camera and made a movie.
Oh, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought of that. It's a great film.
And number four, you probably won't guess, Babe, Pig in the City.
I have to watch that film.
You really, really do. It's on Stan. Do you have Stan?
Yeah.
It's on Stan.
Okay.
And I looked at that top four and I kind of realized with some clarity that... maybe the only thing I'm interested in as a film watcher, in a really deep way, is grotesquerie.
Yeah.
Because those,
which is funny, because I mean the opposite of what I'm interested in, basically.
Yeah.
Sort of.
I still think you're interested in kind of mannered cinematic languages that don't often allow for grotesquerie.
Maybe.
Safe. A grotesque film. Yeah. Babe, Pig in the City, a grotesque film. Sweet Smell of Success, deeply grotesque.
And obviously Texas Chainsaw Massacre is the art of the grotesque.
Yeah, just grotesquery. And I was thinking when I was watching Benjamin Button, and I was really enjoying it, it made me reflect how often melodrama can veer into grotesquery. And I think I'm a sap. By virtue of the fact of how much I love grotesquery. I'm very moved.
Oh, well, what's the name of the film? Rock Hudson.
Yeah, All That Heaven Allows. Yeah. Also grotesque. Yeah. I think that deeply grotesque.
Yeah, especially those kids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, fucking hell. I was thinking about that sequence where they get her a TV.
Yeah, that's one of the most moving sequences in cinema.
And
smartest as well. It's just such a good scene.
They just get her so wrong. They so don't understand her. It's heartbreaking. And I think Curious Case of Benjamin Button is a deeply grotesque film.
Because
he's grotesque at points in his life, and the melodrama is kind of grotesque in an exciting way to me.
Also the kind of... I mean, when he is like a teenager in an old man's body, there's the sequence with the brothel.
Yeah.
And the drinking, this kind
he
of...
He vomits.
Like, yeah. It's to do... I mean, and aging is grotesque, you know? Bodies are grotesque.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a film about a body that's not doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Yeah. I also wanted to say something about the kind of moving ending. I think the film, because it does do this defamiliarization, it kind of reacquaints you with what it means to age, basically. And the thing that the film really... ugh, I just get hit with these, like, waves of nausea. I just feel...
I'm sorry.
Just like... you know when you get that bitter taste in your mouth? Like, it just hits me all at once. One of the successes of the ways that this film reintroduces you to the idea of aging and mortality is that this film made me reflect in a way that kind of nothing has made me reflect on before.
Mm-hmm.
The ways in which birth and death are kind of the same.
Yeah.
Being young and being old are kind of similar.
Yeah.
The film does a good job of showing you that it's a horseshoe, your life. You know, you start weak and powerless and you end weak and powerless, and your relationship to language is, like, very similar.
Not least that it makes sense to have a baby in a nursing home.
Yeah. Like, that's one of the genius things of that opening section, is that he is this, like, baby in an old man's body, treated like an old man, but he is also guarded the way a child would be guarded. You know, he's like... He's constrained in precisely the same way as the old people are constrained.
It's important, I think. You could imagine someone pitching this film in a way that is like, the aging backwards man who has to run away from the circus or from medical science or whatever. And there's just none of that. People are kind of, when they register what's happening, they're mildly surprised and they're like, well, let's make of this the best we can. Yeah. And it's because it's basically the same thing, yeah. right? Like, he's still moving through his life yeah. in a way that is not... Like, the way you gain capability as you grow into adulthood is the same way you gain capability as you... As Pitt ages out of being elderly.
Yeah.
The kind of inexperience of youth matches the incapability of age.
Yeah.
It's not that...
No.
It's strange, just works just enough to make the ordinary shocking.
Yeah. It's a very smart idea for a film, for any kind of story.
Yeah.
Crazy that people didn't think of it before 1922 or whenever Fitzgerald wrote it.
When... So... We didn't. We started telling the story and we didn't really finish it. And maybe it doesn't matter. But just very quickly, he is born into this nursing home, falls in love with the girl who becomes the Cate Blanchett character.
Daisy.
Goes out to sea, gets a kind of education, enjoying being on a boat and kind of being hardworking, being put to work on a boat. Ends up entangled in the war, Second World War. Through that, his ship is sunk, but he's rescued.
Captain Mike dies.
Yeah, the captain of the ship dies, becomes a hummingbird.
Beautiful.
Yeah, we should talk about that in a second.
That means you didn't like
it. Well, I'm not sure. He returns to New York and finds that Cate Blanchett is a ballet dancer for a, like, significant company. And is... doing ballet dancer things and like seeing this young guy. That scene really moved me.
Hmm.
That was distressing. And like moving, you know, when he kind of comes back, he's this... I keep not knowing how to describe him, but he has the appearance of an older man.
Yeah.
Then they end up in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of cross over in each in their 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a child together and he decides he has to leave because he can't be growing younger as the child is growing older. Yeah. Just leaves in the middle of the night. And then... there's this interesting kind of little sequence, which, again, I don't know if it works, where he talks about... And this is kind of the thesis of the film you talked about earlier, where it expresses that... When, the line that's stuck in my head, even though it's corny as hell, is... there's no rules to this thing.
Mm.
Where he and there seems to be something that unlocks the contingency of life in his aging backwards, that you are able to just do whatever you want to do.
Yeah,
right. And that you kind of... like, in a quest... in a way that... And it's important that it doesn't show him becoming, like... he's not a casino's gambling. Like, he's not... he's a cleaner, yeah. you know, in... he's a parking attendant. That's the kind of... the sequence is, like, him... he's in India briefly, like, making this kind of... this little montage of, as he grows younger, just taking these menial jobs to move around the world.
Yeah.
And then he becomes a he becomes a child who has dementia and is reintroduced to Cate Blanchett. He sees her again as a teen in his old age. And she is married and he sees his daughter briefly. And then he becomes a child and she takes... her husband has died. She looks after him. And then he is a baby and he dies. And then, moving out of the flashback, Katrina blacks out the hospital. And as it blacks out the hospital, Cate Blanchett dies.
And then there's this, I think, extremely elegant coda. Very beautiful. Yeah. Deeply moving.
Oh, we didn't talk about the opening. The actual opening. Did we?
What's the actual opening?
The clock.
Yeah, we did.
Did we mention about the reasoning behind the clock?
Not really.
Yeah, doesn't... I think it kind of does. Okay.
Oh, I guess so. I mean, it ties into the thesis, First World War thing. Yeah.
Like, the reason the man makes this clock that goes backwards is because his son dies in the war, and he is like, if only we could make time move backwards.
Yeah. And it doesn't really... I mean, that's the thing, right? It's like, time doesn't really move backwards for Brad Pitt. He's still, like, moving in the same direction as everyone else. Pitt just has this, like, very short little bit of narration where he says, like, some people like to sit by lakes, some people like to sing opera, some people dance. And it's just, like, cutting through significant people in his life with his beautiful voiceover.
Yeah.
And then it's the clock. And it's moving.
Yeah.
It's deeply moving.
It is moving.
I was crying.
Sure.
I was teary through quite a lot of
this film. I was made emotional by this film.
Yeah. It's elegant, I think, is shockingly...
which is not something Fincher is necessarily known for.
I guess because he's so tight. Yeah. He's such a craftsman, there's some kind of elegance, but it often feels kind of like cruel when he does it.
I should watch Gone Girl.
You really should watch Gone Girl. It's good.
Okay, I believe it.
Would that mean that you would have... Movies. Would you finish the Fincher canon if you saw Gone Girl?
What's his first movie?
Alien 3.
I have not seen that.
Have you seen Panic Room?
No. So I'd have to watch those three.
Yeah, you should do it. Panic Room's pretty good.
Yeah, I bet.
Panic Room's okay. It's like a very straight up and down thriller, but it's like effective and fun.
Mm.
I quite like it. Shall we do our special announcement, then do the letterbox game?
Yeah. Do we have any emails or anything from people?
So I have something from Susie.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to do that now or do you want to do that after?
Let's do that now.
We also have an announcement, so we'll tease that.
We're on a slight time limit.
Yeah. We can. I reckon we can get it all done. I'm just going to have a little sip of the tea, so to speak. Oh, wow.
Susie, friend of the podcast, Susie Cray, has been watching all of the George Miller movies. George Miller, one of my favorite filmmakers, which means that she has watched what we haven't watched, Happy Feet 2.
That's coming.
Which is coming, because Brad Pitt. Along with Megamind. So, Susie sent a funny email. On our last episode, I just literally just said, no one in the world has seen Extraction, the Chris Hemsworth movie released on Netflix. And Susie said, not only have I watched it, but I quite enjoyed it. So disproving my theory. So Susie has done this unbelievable calculation, which she was going to send us an email and then basically just messaged me separately and said, like, this thing is crazy. I don't think I can send it as an email. I'll just send it to you here. So she was trying to work out, like, how much time has been spent watching the Chris Hemsworth movie Extraction.
Yeah.
And I want to briefly read you this unbelievable mathematical series of calculations that she's done. Movie has been out for approximately a year. Netflix has said it has been watched by 99 million households. Lol. So Netflix definitely lies about that shit. Like, there's no body that monitors in the same way that the Nielsen ratings do for TV. So nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
Netflix refuses to show specific numbers. They just say crazy things like this.
I will say, and this is a very unscientific mode of study, but often the way I'll start classes for semester is I'll be like, hey, tell me something you really enjoyed over the last year.
Yeah.
People watch a lot of shit on Netflix just on Netflix and you've never heard of. Like, people do just watch Netflix. That's a lot of people do.
And they just go on the top 10 of, like...
It seems to be.
Yeah.
So, maybe.
So, Susie says, viewings or different accounts? True. So, it's not clear. 8,670 hours in a year. Susie's added, what? That seems like too low. Movie lasts 2 hours approximately. Do incomplete viewings count? Extremely good question. Yeah. 99 million divided by 8,670 divided by 2. So 22,602 superfans with Extraction on loop since release. That's what
she's working out, is if it's just people repeat viewing Extraction.
Because... if only over 4 weeks, Google says 99 million views was over 4 weeks, then it needs
294,000 superfans continuously streaming it.
So, and this was a question that Susie asked that I really don't know the answer to. Do actors get paid residuals with Netflix films? Theoretically, could an actor hire someone to sign up for 300,000 Netflix accounts under free trial? I mean, is Netflix going to block someone signing up under the same card or no? Get them to continuously loop for 4 weeks? ? Profit. If it takes 5 minutes to sign up for a Netflix account, that would take 1.5 million minutes. Okay, no, actually, it would take 2.8 years to sign up for that many Netflix accounts if continuously working 24 hours a day. And at that point, paying for the accounts and wages for the person signing up for Netflix accounts would surely outweigh any monetary benefit of this plan. No profit.
So, I think the conclusion
much to think about.
Much to think about, and perhaps a lot of people have watched Extraction.
No, I mean... I appreciate Susie sending the email, but I stay true to the fact that no one's watched Extraction. Even the people who have watched Extraction have not watched Extraction.
I presume it's a sci-fi film or a military film.
It's a military film.
Okay.
He has to extract a young boy who's like torn up in some drug deal war.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter because no one's seen it. No one's watched it.
Yeah.
What can you say but thank you?
Thanks so much, Susie.
Do Netflix actors get paid residuals? That's a very good
question. Because there would be... I mean, there's two things at play, right? One is... I mean, that's part of a union contract.
That you have to get paid residuals. But they
must be streaming stuff worked into contracts where it's not. Yeah.
And also, what happens if you're like... You know that TV series You?
Yeah.
That was like made for a TV network and then sold to Netflix? Like, what happens there?
I mean, my guess is the actors don't usually win out in that scenario.
No.
But Netflix also is probably like better funded than any other production company on Earth, basically.
And residuals, I think, are pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, you can make a lot of money off residuals. Hmm. I'm blowing out this candle. You
should go for it.
My favorite scent in the entire world is vetiver, and this is patchouli and vetiver. Vetiver is in 86% of all perfumes, usually only as a binding agent, not enough to smell, because it's very good at binding. But it's a great smell.
I'll seek it out.
Aesop do a perfume called Hwill, which is primarily vetiver. Hywl.
Sponsor us, Aesop.
This has been our perfume corner.
Scent corner.
Scent corner. What does Brad Pitt smell like?
That's a good question. I think we might have asked that like a year ago.
I think we're going to start running into
an endless loop.
Big announcement.
Mm. Yeah.
We have...
I'm excited too.
We have, after Curious Case of Benjamin Button, 16 more Brad Pitt films.
Unless he makes that train movie within that.
Did you see I posted the photo of him?
No. I've been off Twitter for like 5 days because I've been away. I'll have to look at your Twitter account. Let me see if I can find this photo.
I posted it on the Pitcast account.
Oh, I haven't.
I said the man is working. It's an incredible photo.
Is he on set?
He is.
Oh, well then, we got to hurry up. Oh my gosh.
Incredible photo. Let me see. Let me remember what it looks like. Yeah.
I assume the face shield is not part of the costume.
No, but instead, COVID restrictions. A great photo, right? A
great photo.
Pitt with a torn up shirt with blood on it and a face mask walking around. What is that film going to be like? Fucking no idea. Anyway, one of the directors of Deadpool doing a comedy action film.
Yeah.
Maybe good.
Maybe. Brad Pitt's in it.
So there'll be something fun. We have 16 films remaining. That film's still in production. It won't come out for like 2 years, probably.
Sure.
Particularly with the way the world is.
Yeah.
Production will presumably get shot down like 7 times. Excuse me.
Is it being made in LA?
I assume so. Come to Australia, Sydney, Australia, Brad Pitt.
Please. Oh my gosh, can you imagine?
What would we do?
I don't know.
I was sitting in one of the doctor's appointments. We're really stretching out the tease of the special announcement. And I was just thinking, you know, I think it would be easy for us to get Andrew Dominik and David Michaud, two Australian filmmakers, on to talk about their films. I think we try and get Dominik on the Killing Them Softly episode, and we try and get them Michaud on the War Machine episode. These two people remain in a working relationship with Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
It is at least worth a try to ask the question to these men, can you ask...
Get his email.
Can we just try something?
Yeah.
Even if he just records us like a fucking 30-second...
Yeah. It would be wild.
It would be very, very unlikely.
Yeah.
But you know...
I'd say like 5... maybe 2%, 1% chance.
Blake Howard, who did the incredible podcast One Heat Minute, in which he went through the film Heat minute by minute, got Michael Mann on the last episode.
Yeah.
Michael Mann, not as famous as Brad.
Pretty famous.
You know, you interview people, you talk to people who are connected, and you see what you can do.
Yeah.
We have 16 Brad Pitt films remaining.
Mm-hmm.
On a recent episode, Wave of Nausea. This is not me being theatrical. No. I really do just feel like shit.
He's doing so well.
Me?
Yeah, you're really holding up. You're making a go of this episode, given that you feel like shit.
I really am trying. On a recent episode, we discussed doing a podcast called Four or Fewer, in which we do the filmographies of filmmakers who make four films or fewer.
Yeah.
We decided, moments before starting recording, that we will alternate for the remainder of the Brad Pitt films between a four-film miniseries. A four-film... film miniseries by a director covering their entire filmography.
Yeah.
And then do four Brad Pitt films. So we'll flip back and forth.
I'm currently reading 2666 by Roberto Bolaño. Mm-hmm. And I've read like five books within reading 2666.
Sensible.
Because it's
over 1,000 pages.
It is also like kind of structured in four or five books itself.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm like 2/3 of the way through.
Good book.
It's a great book.
Yeah, really good book.
Yeah, but that's the... Yeah. Well, my thoughts on this are that primarily is the way... Like, Pitt is at a point in his career where he is doing other things. He's producing. He's turning up on SNL. He's, you know...
Slowing down.
He's slowing down. And we might... I think it will more... It will give us kind of time and space to think through the rhythm of that later career Brad Pitt. And we also have, like, a higher hit rate of films you, dear listener, will have seen. And films that are kind of... There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
So it will be nice, I think, to spread it out a little bit.
And take the time.
I hope you're all okay with that.
I think people will be. We have a committed and loving listenership.
Definitely.
Who will follow us down whichever so roads.
Shoot someone in Fifth Avenue.
Listen, Dan, Trump is not part of anyone's life anymore. You don't need to invoke him. It's crazy how much that man no longer exists.
It's wild. I remember having really, really thinking during his presidency, when will be the first day that I like don't think of Donald Trump? At least once in the day. And I think my feeling then was like, it's going to be 10 or 15 years away.
Yeah.
Actually, I've probably had a few since he's no longer president.
I've had a lot.
You know what's much more effective than him not being president anymore? Him being off Twitter.
Yeah.
That's most of it. I'd say that's 80% of it.
Yeah. He's just not there.
Yeah.
He's gone. You're wonderful.
It's pretty good. Four films.
Alternating. Because of this, the fact that we have 16 films... remaining. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button is the last episode before we start this alternating procedure. So we're going to start a mini series with the very next episode.
I assume we're going to be doing them in chronological order.
Yeah. So Four or Fewer will work. We'll just literally do, as we have done with the Pitt cast, we'll just do this director's first film, second film, third film, fourth film. Just in order. We'll do it. It will be structurally precisely the same as the Pitt cast, I assume, in that we'll be talking about the biographical details of the filmmaker. Letterboxd, all the things that you've come to know and love will be the same, but we will be looking at filmmakers who have made... I mean, maybe, depending on how long Four or Fewer lasts, maybe we won't always do directors who have made basically nothing but masterpieces. But the first couple of filmmakers... have been selected because they have made
good films,
nothing but masterpieces. Do you want to announce our first filmmaker?
First filmmaker, first director, the inimitable Lynn Ramsey.
Lynn Ramsey, director of these four films: Ratcatcher, Morven Callor, We Need to Talk About Kevin, You Were Never Really Here. Dan has seen one of those films, which is extremely exciting.
Yeah, and I loved it. I saw it at the Sydney Film Festival a few years ago.
Which one was it?
You Were Never Really Here.
Deeply underrated film.
It's shocking to me. I think it's one of those films where, because I saw it, I'm not quite... Like, you just assume everyone loves it. You know that, like, sometimes you'll just not quite clock a film's popularity? But no one ever talks about
it. No one ever talks about it. It disappeared.
Which is crazy. Basically a perfect film.
So beautiful, so moving, so laced with tragedy, so strange.
Like, willing to do some very, very cool things.
The sequence in which Joe is lying on the floor next to the guy who he shot and they sing together.
Yeah, in his grandmother's house.
Yeah, unbelievable.
His mother's house, maybe. But his mother.
The sequence in which he, like, dives into the lake, maybe to commit suicide. Yeah,
extraordinary. Like, the scene, the like, fake... I won't say what it is because... I don't want to spoil it, but the fake-out scene towards the end of the film.
Yeah. The sequence in which he comes to his kind of, like, fence, who sets him up with his jobs, and the guy has clearly been tortured and has had knives through his hands, and the knives have been removed, and there's just, like, these holes in his hands. Every one of Lynn Ramsey's films are great.
Great.
I would highly recommend, if you're a listener of the podcast, we don't always stress that you should watch the films, but if you go on a journey with us... where you watch the four films as we do.
It'll be a delight.
You'll be able to submerge yourself in the world of a filmmaker who is not frequently discussed in the culture, who's not paid attention with the level of commitment that we're going to do. It's hard to find stuff about Ramsey. She's not treated as an auteur the way she should be.
Also, if you're a committed listener to the podcast, you will probably be able to guess some of the other filmmakers we are doing.
Yeah. We've talked about some.
Yeah. So... you know, watch their films too.
Yeah.
But we won't, just in case, we might be changing it about, so we'll see how we go. But
Ramsey
is locked in.
The next time you hear from us, we will be talking about Lynn Ramsey's gorgeous, highly heralded debut, Ratcatcher, which is a coming-of-age drama, in a way, that is filled with Ramsey's usual sense of lyricism. Tilda Swinton, who worked with Ramsey on We Need to Talk About Kevin, she's the star of We Need to Talk About Kevin, said, this is designed to get you all excited, Lynn Ramsey is one of the few filmmakers who, if she didn't make these movies, they genuinely wouldn't exist.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That'll give you a sense of what we're going to do.
Should we do a few quick letterboxes?
It's possible that my doctor's going to call, in which case you might have to take over proceedings by yourself, Dan.
Totally okay. Maybe just 1 5-star and 1 1-star.
Perfect. Or we could just do the most popular reviews.
Yeah, let's just do that.
My two suggested Google searches for Letterboxd are Curious Case of and Cultural Politics of Emotion.
I see you.
The book by Jürgen Habermas, a contemporary philosopher.
Most popular?
So Lana, whose top four films are... In the Mood for Love. Excellent film. Wong Kar-wai is In the Mood for Love. The Wind Rises. I
can't watch that.
It's really good.
Okay.
It's really good. A film I've never heard of called Good Morning, directed by Ozu, who's a big old gap in my knowledge of cinema. And Asako 1 and 2, which came out in 2018, is directed by Ryosuke Hamaguchi. Never heard of it. Lana's review.
The 2-hour wait before Brad Pitt gets hot. More suspenseful than Hitchcock.
Great. Very funny. Logan Kenny, who's a friend, just gave it 5 stars and said, love is the most important thing of all. Ashley, another friend, says, a film about embracing life is probably not the best thing to watch when I'm in bed depressed and have spent 6 months of the years in tours.
Yeah, not a great lockdown film.
Brat Pitt, who's very famous on Letterboxd, 3.5 stars.
Father Fincher really made me wait 1 whole hour for Cate Blanchett to show up and a whopping 1 hour and 52 minutes for Brad Pitt to get hot. Oh, Finch would be hashtag cancelled if I wasn't lodged up so far his asshole.
Incredible review just by Adrian Balboa, whose top four films are...
The Social Network. Oh, very funny. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. So big Finch fans. Manchester by the Sea and Ordinary People.
Ordinary People, good movie. You would like that. Directed by Robert Redford.
Yeah, okay, that's right.
Have you seen Manchester by the Sea?
No.
You'd also like that one.
Okay, I didn't finish this. It's 3 hours long and the tiny old man frightened me.
Maybe the final word.
Yeah.
Should be that review. I think a lot of people reacted with fear to the character of Benjamin Button.
It was nightmarish in part. His father, first of all, right?
Yeah.
And I get it. Well, I wouldn't, you know.
Yeah. You wouldn't abandon him, maybe. No. You wouldn't steal a car. You wouldn't abandon a baby.
All right.
This is a surprisingly short episode for one of the longest movies that we've covered.
I think partially because it's a film of great depth.
Yeah.
But not that much happens.
No.
It's not that plotty.
No,
it's story's really not that important. Love story.
Yeah.
Okay, Blanchett breaks her leg. I don't think we talked about that. Her ballet career is over.
Great.
Sad.
A classic, yeah. I think a great film. I give this film 4 stars. I give this film 4 bags of popcorn.
3.5. Maybe 4. I'll think about it. I'll report back next week when I've... And when we'll be doing Ratcatcher.
Extremely excited.
I'm really excited about this. And it's not totally new for us. Like, we've done non-Pitt films before. So
exactly.
It's within a pattern of the Pitt cast.
I'm just going to quickly check if Ratcatcher is on the Criterion channel, just because that will make it easy for listeners to find. If not, if you have a VPN, you can rent it from American YouTube. Criterion have put out a DVD.
Doesn't seem to be.
No, but we need to talk about Kevin. It's interesting.
Oh, good.
Yeah, Ratcatcher. You'll be able to find it. If you live near Sydney University, Sydney University Library has like 3 copies of Ratcatcher for some reason. Incredible film. You'll have an incredible time. And fucking Lynn Ramsey.
Yeah.
We could probably try and contact Lynn Ramsey and see if she'll talk to us. She's not doing anything.
Maybe for You're Never Really Here.
A New Dawn.
Yeah. Well, let's not get the listeners hopes up. We're going to see what we can do.
It's regardless A New Dawn.
Yeah. All right. Thank you all so much. I would recommend Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Who'd have thought?
What a beautiful thing to hear come out of your lips, Daniel.
We love you. We'll see you next time.
We'll see you next time for fucking Ratcatcher.
Bye.
Motherfucker. Oh, look at Lynn Ramsey's profile picture on Wikipedia. Display, you know, the main picture of her to get yourself excited, because it's the best picture on Wikipedia.
It's wild.
See you next time. Bye. For Ratcatcher.